and welcome to Cinemarathon, the Movie Marathons podcast, where we watch a series of movies all in one day and then talk about them afterwards. This is part two of the Mission Impossible Cinemarathon. If you missed part one, be sure to go back and listen to that. But if you're all cut up, then just relax and listen to part two of the Mission Impossible Cinemarathon.
Let's gladly run screaming from Mission Impossible 2 and move on to Mission Impossible 3.
The original director slated to do Mission Impossible 3 was David Fincher.
Whoa, yeah. Really?
David Fincher was slated to direct Mission Impossible 3, but dropped out to do Lords of Dogtown.
Oh, okay. I remember that.
No, to direct it, but then dropped out of that and just produced it, and I guess did some second unit stuff with the skateboarding, and his next movie ended up being Zodiac.
Which is great.
Which is, thankfully, in my opinion, his best movie. But
it's a pretty good movie.
I just find that an interesting path that he goes from MI3 to Lords of Dogtown to go, nah, I'm not going to direct this either. And, you know, he's just such a finicky director. It's just funny to watch him do that. But
well, I imagine in that case, Mission Impossible 3 would have less, like, lens flares and more, like, penile, like, death-stabbing apparatuses. You know, like,
wow.
I'm sorry. I think David Fincher, all I can think about is in Seven, that fucking, like, rig that from the Lust, like, murder.
The knife strap on.
It haunts Fincher. You haunt me in my dreams with that thing.
Effective filmmaker, Fincher.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's just interesting to think about.
But in fact, they got J.J. Abrams.
Yep.
To direct it.
And that was the other thing I came across was basically, I forget who this, they tried to get another director.
Joe Carnahan.
Fincher. Yeah, Carnahan. Yeah. And that didn't work out. And so Tom Cruise basically just watching television, and he powered through the first two seasons of Alias and then just picked up the phone and called J.J. Abrams and be like, you're doing a spy movie. We're doing a spy movie. You do a spy TV show and it's awesome. So why don't you come direct this movie?
Yeah. And I must confess, I've actually never seen Alias, but I imagined being a spy genre that, you know, Abrams is like a pretty good fit for this Mission Impossible.
As a director, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the first couple of seasons of Alias are so good that, I mean, Quentin Tarantino pops in as a character because he basically called J.J. Abrams to be like, I love this show so much and it's so amazing and I need to give me a role or something like that. And he did. And he actually plays a really interesting character. I mean, we won't get into Alias because that show goes off the rails after season two. But the first two seasons are really, really amazing. And so I can understand watching those.
If this guy kept watching, he'd be like, cancel that call or whatever. Like,
well, I mean, but really, that's more of a story thing than anything else. And they probably just brought J.J. Abrams in to direct the movie. Whereas the story was handled, I mean, Cruise is a producer on all of these movies. So him and his partner, Paula Wagner, you know, they probably were in control of the story from the start. I was reading that they were in control of the story during the De Palma. You know, that they had approval over everything. So clearly they're the ones running the show for the most part on the producing end. So, which is weird when you see what happens with two. I know I posited the theory that the studio interfered, but then I go, but did they? but either way, even if they're responsible for two, they clearly recognized the error of their ways and went back to something much stronger. To me, the story of this movie isn't really J.J. Abrams. It's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, my God. Yes. He's the best part of that movie.
He is the best villain of the four, in my opinion. Like, I know the John Voight thing is a nice little turn and a trick and a nod to the old television show, and he's really good and everything, but just the menace that Philip Seymour Hoffman brings to that character is fantastic. And I also, he's one of my favorite actors. And from my hometown of Rochester, too, so I have a little bit of a bias, but he's awesome.
He definitely raises that movie from, like, really fun, solid action movie to, like, very incredibly watchable, interesting film. I mean, I have to admit that going into the marathon, Mission Impossible 3 was the only movie I hadn't seen. I'd actually gone out in theater and saw Ghost Protocol, and was slightly confused occasionally because obviously those two sort of carry over in a way I wasn't expecting. And I was like, what's going on here? but Mission Impossible 3, especially that cold open in the movie, like before the credits, such a different, they very immediately go like, this is not the same movie you've been watching, that we are going a totally different direction for this one. Well, he fucking like stone cold, like seemingly, you know, murders his wife right in front of you. And you're like, holy shit. Like, it's amazing.
Well, it goes back to what Pat, what you were saying about how the cold open from the first movie where they're making someone think something's going on in a room.
That's exactly.
But now it's happening to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This isn't a joke anymore.
The tables
this
turned.
Isn't a trick. Right. It's really happening.
He's no longer in control.
Mm-hmm. And it's to me, it's an incredibly interesting storytelling technique to show us that deep into the future and give us this hint of like, his wife's life is on the line. And Hoffman gives just such an amazing performance at the beginning. It's clearly viscerally hating like Ethan Hunt and just being such a prick, like torturing him. And so there's all this interesting sort of ironic moments in the movie. Like I remember like early on, Ethan Hunt sort of has Philip Seymour Hoffman and he's like staring him down. He's like, I'm going to kill your wife right in front of you. And like, and you kind of that's going to happen.
He's just like, I'm going to find out, you know, who you are. And because he didn't, someone end up basically saying his name.
And that's it was Luther. It was Luther. He's saying, Ethan, no, stop.
Exactly. And so Philip Seymour Hoffman's like, so your name's Ethan. Yeah. There's a big thing that Philip Seymour Hoffman, he doesn't know who he is or what he has, but he's like, you have someone that you love, or I forget what the exact words were, but he's basically like,
I'm
going to
fucking kill him.
I'm going to find him. And but it's not, that's the thing is, I'm going to fucking kill him.
Oh, right. He's so calm, like, man.
I'm going to find him and I'm going to hurt him. And it's just like, just so, it's so dark and it's awesome. Yeah. It's awesome. In my perfect world, Philip Seymour Hoffman would have been in the first movie with the like dark, twisted De Palma like approach.
Yeah.
I would actually love to see Brian De Palma direct Philip Seymour Hoffman somewhere because that would be great. But yeah, he's the best part of the movie. And I think he carries it too because I don't know about you guys, but I don't really care about the girl, Michelle Monaghan.
We're supposed to care because Ethan cares.
Yeah, it's only as far as she's important.
But see, that's also one of the slight flaws of this movie. And I like this movie, don't get me wrong. But and it's a huge improvement, you know, over the second one. But there's just something I don't care about Michelle Monaghan. And the thing about Cruise in this series is he's good, but I don't end up caring for his character at any point. He is an agent. He is like, I don't know, in a way it's, I don't care about his relationships to people. I care about him and his mission.
That's true.
And so all of a sudden we get sucked into this personal story, which is okay if it works, but to me it doesn't work as well.
I actually found that an intriguing story device, at least to mix it up a bit. And honestly, I don't know how much of this is like in Marathon. It's always nice to vary it up.
Sure.
Because if it had been same old Ethan Hunt, you know, I'd probably be a little more bored. But there was something about him, like, having this secret life and holding down this sort of wife-to-be and getting married. And now it's not just about him. He has something he cares about in the real world. And the opening especially, putting it on the line of, like, if he keeps this up, he could lose this woman. Like, I don't know. I found it pretty interesting.
It's really, I mean, and we should, I guess, preface the fact that the movie starts with, I mean, he's retired. Like, that's the way this whole thing has gone, is that he's, you know, retired from being a secret
agent.
After
Mission Impossible 2, he's like, maybe I should give this up. You know?
Yeah. He had started training people, and then he's out of the service completely.
And his wife has no idea who he was or what he did or anything like that, and, of course, what he ends up doing. It's not – I actually don't have any problem with the choice of the story. It's just – I don't know. There's something about it that I don't care.
Is it her as, like, an actress?
It's that, and it's also – I don't know. I don't – in the universe, I have never, even in the first – even the first movie, which I like – grow to care about Ethan Hunt as a person. I care, you know what I mean? I don't identify with him as a character on an emotional level.
He's more like a storytelling.
It's fun to watch him. I cheer for him to win and all that, but I don't identify on an emotional level with him. And right at the beginning of the movie, in essence, we're supposed to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we're just supposed to be like, oh, I feel bad for him that he has to go back into the service and, you know, he's caught up in this danger and then his wife. And it's, I don't know, there's an emotional connection that's missing for me to really care about it. And so I feel a little detached from it. It's still well handled, but that's a slight flaw to me, is that it could have been better handled from a story perspective to make me care a little bit more.
I have to confess, I think a lot of the reason it works for me is the cold open of the movie.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have that sort of foresight, And this is the other thing, and maybe this is just kind of my bad because of the order in which I watch these movies, but having seen Ghost Protocol prior to this movie, there's a lot of talk in that movie about it seemingly that she's dead.
Yeah. See,
and then at the very end of the movie, you know, in Ghost, I mean, I'm jumping ahead, but in Ghost Protocol, she comes out like, hey, look, I'm not dead. I'm here.
Right.
So I'm going into watching Mission Impossible 3 with the reality of 4 is that she's deceased.
Oh, so you so actually to me, thought she died. To me, it died.
Was very, very... Now, I obviously knew she wasn't actually dead because at the end of Ghost Protocol, she's not dead.
Right.
But I thought it was incredibly possible that in the reality of the third Mission Impossible movie, she could be dead or at least thought to be dead.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So
and
it,
that
it,
he goes the whole movie, it, yeah. like, my wife is dead.
I mean, obviously, this isn't the order or way these movies are meant to be watched, but that sort of way of watching it lent to me a credibility of the possibility of her dying that frankly if I'd have just gone into Mission Impossible 3 with no information, being a kind of a savvy moviegoer, I would watch a cold open within 10 or 20 minutes, be like, you know what, she's probably not dead, because why would they show me that if she was actually gonna get killed?
Yeah.
But it's, I don't know, for some reason it felt very possible to me that could be her end.
Yeah.
And so Tom Cruise is amazing in that opening, and just sort of the pain and sort of freak out that he's doing. So that just put me in a mindset where I felt really bad for him. So then seeing him, it's like even all the nice moments with his wife where everything's okay, I'm actually like inside kind of sad because I'm like, damn, she's going to get like tied up and tortured. I kind of feel bad for him even now when he's happy. So,
well, maybe a little bit more of it is.
But I get you.
Maybe a little bit more of it is tied to Michelle Monaghan. I don't know. She's not bad or anything.
Yeah.
It's just it's flat. There's no I don't watch her and feel really bad. She's, I don't know, she feels like a face plugged in a part. She doesn't feel like an actress bringing something to the role.
I also kind of have to confess I have a little bit of a crush on her, so that probably helps too. Right.
I think she works well as a device to motivate Ethan. So far, all three of these movies have been very personally motivated for Ethan. You know, his team gets killed and now he's being painted as a mole. It's personal.
Yeah.
And the second one, you know, the girl's been injected with the virus and, you know, there's an agent been betrayed the agencies. It's personal. And now his wife's life is at stake. And even before his wife's life is at stake, the agent that he was most proud of had been captured and it's a rescue mission.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Felicity, right?
Yeah. And that's what leads
JJ
into that's what leads into the like to the plot of and the capture of Philip Seymour Hoffman's
right.
character.
Yeah. And she dies a fucking grisly ass death. It's like with like brain bomb or whatever.
Yeah.
Her
yeah,
eyeballs all
a,
fucked up.
Yeah,
like,
there's a charge implanted in her brain.
That shit's rough.
And they don't shy away from showing her dead body.
Yeah, just cross-eyed corpse just lying there.
What's nice about that, too, is... nice.
how delightful.
It was fucking awesome.
But what's good about it is that, they, like you guys are saying, they don't shy away from... I mean, I wouldn't expect them to kill her. You know, they literally did rescue her. They're on the way...
Yep.
You know, to safety and everything's fine, and then that charge goes off and she's dead. And everything they've just done is basically for naught. Again, you're pulling at the emotional angle when it comes to Ethan, and that is a different choice. To me, that was more effective than the wife stuff, because I don't know, I felt that. There was a moment between him and Carrie Russell that I believed and I felt that attachment, and it's helped by, you know, the flashback a little bit, but
yeah.
I believe that relationship, and I felt that loss more so than I did with Michelle Monaghan.
Yeah, I also liked seeing him as like a Kill Bill-esque like sensei. I mean, there's something about that was just cool to me. Him sort of training this woman.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Lawrence Fishburne?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Lawrence Fishburne's in the movie. It's weird. Like, I really like Lawrence Fishburne, but he's not like particularly memorable. Oh, they do sort of, they kind of go back to the vibe of the first movie where there is like another mole or someone, a bad person.
Exactly.
Well, that's been the vibe for all three movies so far.
Yeah. And there's also Billy Crudup is in there too. And they do this sort of back and forth where like they make you think Lawrence Fishburne's the bad guy and that Billy Crudup's really helping him out. And then it sort of turns out like Billy Crudup's actually the bad guy. And that was like kind of interesting.
Yeah, see, to me, that was of all three movies, like it's the most predictable or all three movies so far. It's the most predictable twist to me. I'm just like, because it's like we've kind of been down the misdirection road before. And it just, at a certain stage, you start to be able to
sniff it out
a little bit. And I mean, it does help that we're watching these in a marathon. Again, we talked about how many years are in between these movies. So if you hadn't watched the other two before going to see the third one, I could see not being necessarily able to call it. But after seeing the misdirection and in the first one, really, it's just kind of like, I'm like, Lawrence Fishburne is not the problem here. It's the guy trying to help you. It seemed a little obvious to me that it was going to be Billy Crudup.
That's fair. And this movie has a very interesting sort of MacGuffin in this, what do they call it? The rabbit's foot?
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
I do love that twist because it is, I mean, it's not even a twist. It's just, I mean, that's a pure call out to Hitchcock and what he invented, which is the MacGuffin.
And for anyone who doesn't know, it's essentially like a plot device that it doesn't really matter what the object or thing is. It's just sort of like the thing that gets the story going.
Yeah, it is the thing that drives the story. And
in this case, literally an unexplained, sort of mysterious rabbit's foot.
I mean, you think about it. Other examples are Pulp Fiction and that briefcase and what's in that briefcase.
Or Ronan.
Another one is actually this is a direct nod from Pulp Fiction, but Kiss Me Deadly, which is also a briefcase.
You know what's interesting? I was actually completely by coincidence, I was on Snopes the other day, and there was an article about that briefcase thing. And Tarantino is actually quoted as saying that when he wrote Pulp Fiction, it was not an intentional nod to that film. He had actually like not seen it, or at least hadn't seen it in a long time, and it was a pure coincidence.
Wow,
that it wasn't directly. And I think what happened, they even said on set, it's like they were just going to shoot the briefcase, open it up, and it just be anything. And then literally while they were shooting it, someone had the cute idea of like, what if we put a little light in here.
Oh yeah.
And that's really what opens it up to the mystery of like this glowing light. And it's cool because the briefcase is glowing in Kiss Me Deadly, but apparently Tarantino confesses it's not it's obviously, it seems like a nod, but he didn't intentionally mean it to be. But that's cool.
I don't know. Yeah, intentionally, sure, but you know, he's such a movie buff.
Yeah, and it's the same concept.
If he had I'm not arguing that he like stole it or something like that, but it's one of those things that, you know, sometimes unconsciously you're just doing it.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Because that's such a strong image from Kiss Me Deadly. But anyway, that's getting sidetracked. The whole MacGuffin thing is really a lot of fun in this movie. The fact that we never find out what the rabbit's foot is, and that it's just this thing, and that's ultimately the point of it. And I love that they kind of elbow you a little bit as an audience member to make you realize that ultimately the plot of the movie that you're watching doesn't really matter. It's all how it plays out and how the characters interact.
Definitely.
And that's all you end up really caring about. And plot is really just a distraction. And any movie that really focuses on plot and only cares about plot is missing the point.
That's fair.
And we really never see the heist. Like we see his entrance and his exit, but we never see what transpires.
It dwells on his...
It helps to lend more to, we don't know what the rabbit's foot is because we don't know what kind of facility it was being stored in. It has biohazard markings on it.
Right.
So, you know, we were probably assuming it came from some kind of lab,
but
we didn't get to see the lab. So we don't know what the lab entails. Were there like monkeys in cages, or, you know, was it, like, you know, who
was
knows?
It a bubble?
It was the rage virus from 28 days later.
Yeah.
That was it.
So, yeah, we don't know anything about it. I mean, you know, they put biohazard things on garbage cans that doctors throw their gloves into.
Yep.
I mean, it could be anything, but it's not the point. The point is getting his wife back.
Yeah. There's also an incredibly interesting sequence towards the end of the movie where I guess Ethan Hunt has the same brain bomb electro thing.
When he gets captured, they
and his he's
him.
Now like essentially rescued his wife, and she has to she conveniently is like a nurse or whatever, hey, whatever, it's fine. And she knocks him out, and there's like an extended sequence.
He knocks himself out.
Oh, right.
She is utterly terrified.
Yeah, right. But there's a pretty cool sequence where she has no idea, like, he's an agent, what's going on. He just kind of shows her how to use a gun and is like, good luck, honey, and just like pieces out. And she's like fending off bad guys and fighting. And to me, that was such a cool way to go, because, you know, it was very modern to me, because so often like a woman's in danger and the man comes to save her. It's it's cool and empowering to give his wife a gun and let her sort of be the protector and piece Ethan out of the movie.
Right.
I didn't expect that, and I thought that was cool.
That's a little J.J. Abrams nod/twist. I mean, that's what he's kind of known for, is, you know, a lot of his shows on TV feature strong female characters, you know, whether it's Felicity, and I know literally he puts Felicity in this movie as an agent and everything.
Or Kate from Lost.
But yeah, and then obviously Alias that's Jennifer Garner all the way. So it's a neat little, I think that's one of the interesting things to watch in all of these movies. Probably Ghost Protocol has the least of it, but all of these directors put their own little spin flourishes on it.
There's a little bit of it in Ghost Protocol, which we can talk about later.
I would say it's still the least of the four. You know, I can, when I watch the first one, that's a De Palma film.
Yeah.
When you watch the second one, that's a like shitty Hollywood John Woo film. Really no question about it. You couldn't mistake it for anybody else. And then the third movie is very much a J.J. Abrams film. It looks and feels like his television shows, like his movies. And this is his first movie. This is his directorial debut. And we got into a little bit of a discussion. I won't bring it up too much because we don't have to rehash the whole thing. But that's also the thing that distracts me a little bit in this movie is it does feel like a guy who's used to making television making the leap to the big screen. He's got a big budget to play with. He's got big movie stars. And yet there's just something about the way he lights it and the way the camera works that it makes it feel a little small. There are some set pieces. There are some action pieces that work well. But overall, there's something about the house at the beginning and even the scenes with Philip Seymour Hoffman when he's torturing him near the end. Like, those scenes feel like they're taking place. Like, they could have been part of a television show.
Yeah.
The way they're lit, the way they're shot, and it's just he's learning. He's a television director. He's not used to this budget and this scale. And I think the interesting thing to compare to it is that the budget for this movie is the same, like identical to the budget of Ghost Protocol. And Ghost Protocol is balls to the wall.
They do
so much more with that budget in terms of action set pieces and places they go and all of that. So I think that speaks a little bit to, it's not a bad movie. It's not poorly shot or poorly directed or anything like that, but there is a little bit of you can sense a learning curve of a guy who used to be in television learning to make bigger scale movies.
Well, we don't have to rehash the entire argument, but I will say mildly, obviously if the man has a directing style that he developed in television and you watch a lot of J.J. Abrams television, the movie's going to feel similar because it looks like a J.J. Abrams movie. I'll give you, especially in dialogue scenes and stuff, the way those are sort of set up and shot. The opposite I can think of is like De Palma in the restaurant scene where he's going like Dutch angles and being
it's
super creative.
It's not just, over the shoulder, reverse angle, simple.
So I'll give you that for most of Mission Impossible 3. Although I will say there are many extended action sequences where dude can shoot a camera because some awesome like crane moves and sweeping shots and sort of setups that are very like not television that look awesome.
Well that's the other thing too though is that having watched Alias and having watched him shoot action scenes, you can see those too. So
yeah, but he shoots television the way other people don't.
I agree with that
like,
but
he brought movie style shooting to television, so to be like it looks like TV, that's a little fair.
Well, no, I agree that his television is elevated over other, examples of television. He brought something to TV that didn't exist as much. But I don't know, when you look at it from the evolutionary standpoint, there is a big gap between the action in, say, Mission Impossible 3 and the action in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. There is a gap in the way it's shot and the kind of epic scale and approach to it. Yeah.
To be fair, Mission Impossible 3 has way more action. Like, that is like a big action movie. Now, I'm not talking about in quality. I'm just saying I think he had a lot more of it to get through.
Sure.
There are like these extended run and gun kind of military, we're going to get, Bin Laden kind of
helicopter chase.
Yeah, military action scenes that really aren't in Ghost Protocol. And frankly, like quite kind of for the better. Because Mission Impossible 3 is way more, it seems to me, like a military shooter action movie than like a spy movie.
Yeah. To be honest, and this will be the last thing I say.
Oh, no, it's okay.
But the last thing that probably more stands out to me is the J.J. Abrams thing is the lighting throughout the movie is so much more, it feels kind of forced, like I'm going to make this kind of blue-green, like yellowish with red and orange. It just feels so overlit.
Right.
And it feels like, and that's the thing is that's one of the tools that a television director will use to make his show look, bigger and better because he only has to operate with sets most of the time is he lights it in a certain way to make it look darker, dangerous, or more unique because he doesn't, otherwise it's just a set.
Yeah.
Whereas movies obviously have more of a budget and can go out and shoot a lot of places. And that's the thing is you watch the difference between Ghost Protocol Ghost Protocol is like, there's so much shot during the day and natural lighting. Like, Brad Bird does not like that movie and the kind of deliberate, okay, here's a green, you know, room, or here's a, you know, yellow orangish feel for this entire scene. It's just like, no, we're just going to shoot this mostly in natural light. And I think it works better because, and De Palma does the same thing too. Again, yeah. It's a slight difference between a film director and a guy who honed and got his chops going in television. And it's just, that's a one slight detriment to me.
Well, I'll completely give you that. Because Mission Impossible 3 does have that slick, color-corrected to shit look that, like, basically everything now looks like, because you can do it on a computer in 5 minutes. Yeah. That, like, yeah, thank God Brad Bird is not doing it that way. Yeah.
It's still a good movie. It's just, that's one of the kind of slight ticks against it for me. And that also, to give J.J. Abrams credit, that is something that he does less of as he gets on in further movies. Definitely. Like, when you look at Star Trek or even Super 8, which I don't even like Super 8 that much, those movies are much more cinematic. Granted, he gets more obsessed with lens flares in those movies, but still... I mean, that is a, you know, speaking to the fact that he's evolving as a director and embracing his ability to shoot differently and not just go with the same old style that he's used to.
Definitely. But going from television to film, mm-hmm. and like, if you had to put it on a scale of whether or not he did a good job transitioning,
he absolutely,
I would say he did a great job.
I completely agree with you. He definitely did do a good job. It's just... when you're stacked up against, in my book, Brad Bird or Brian De Palma, you're going to come in a distant third place, but you're still going to be better than John.
Yeah, I was about to say, I was like, we can all agree.
I would much rather watch Mission Impossible 3 every day for the next 2 weeks than ever watch Mission Impossible 2 again.
Did anybody else have anything else about Mission Impossible 3?
I like again, to harken back to the music, now with Bad Robot being a producer of the film, and that's J.J. Abrams' production company, and he mm-hmm. and his cohorts. They also bring along with them Michael Giacchino.
Oh, yeah, he's so good.
What
a great composer.
We're going to hear again in the next film. It's really fun to hear the Mission Impossible theme in this one, because it feels so much more heavy and threatening.
Yeah.
There's a lot more bass in it. A lot more bongo music too. Even though Danny Elfman also had bongos too, there's even more in just the theme itself. So
as well, it should be.
Yeah, it's like the original theme.
Exactly.
I wanted to bring up something that will lead into the second movie, and that's Simon Pegg's character.
The second of three and four.
The
fourth
part of Simon Pegg's return. What? I don't know what I'm saying.
The Simon Pegg series.
Yeah. because he will cross over into the next movie. And, you know, his character, we see his character, I think, once towards the beginning of the movie. And then, like, there's a really great, like, action sequence where he's running and Simon Pegg has to relay coordinates to him as he's running.
Yeah, he's sort of like a bit player in the third movie. Which, that was another thing, having seen the fourth movie before the third movie. I love Simon Pegg in the fourth movie. So I knew he was in the third movie. And I'm like, can't wait for more Simon Pegg. And then, like, he's, like, barely in it. And I was like, aw. I was really sad. But he's funny for what he's in, mm-hmm. for sure. Let's move on to the fourth and final film of the marathon, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Which is, you know, honestly, kind of fucking awesome.
Pretty good.
I love Ghost Protocol. Like, it is way too much fun than it has any business being. Like, it's awesome.
Second best of the series for me, behind the first one.
Yeah. Yeah, I might be as bold as to say that it's my favorite one. I don't know if I could sit here and make some sort of film studies case of why it's a better movie than the first one. I think the first one's probably the best made, like, movie.
You enjoy the fourth one.
Yeah, I had the best time with Ghost. That movie is so entertaining from, like, front to back. Like, there's no downtime. You're just constantly entertained. It's great.
It is very entertaining. I have a lot of issues with some of the plot, but it's just nonstop action, adrenaline, and I've seen it twice now. So it's certainly a lot of fun in that respect.
And it's really funny. Like, it's almost like, I mean, it's not full-on comedy, but, like, it definitely is a little more lighthearted.
Yes.
I mean, talking about Mission Impossible 3, like, wife gets murdered in front of Ethan Hunt's eyes. This movie's, like, a little more kind of tongue-in-cheek fun. Like,
that's actually one of the small takes against it, in my opinion, is that at times it feels a little too light.
No such thing, man.
when you consider the consequences of what they're dealing with, you know, a nuclear device and everything, right. It's just, I don't know, there's a few too many light moments for me. I appreciate them, but and I like Simon Pegg, and I do think he's funny, but there are some times where it just feels a little, like, for me, when they're walking in because Simon Pegg is now in the field, which in the third movie, he's just a computer nerd type in the at the home base, whereas in the fourth, he's become a field op, which is kind of weird, to be honest, but whatever.
It's also kind of who cares, because he's really funny, and I'll totally allow it. It's
when they're walking into the Kremlin, and he makes, like, a couple of, you know, like, I can't believe I'm in the field with you.
I want to wear a mask.
It's kind of funny for, like, the first line or two, and then I'm with Tom Cruise. Like, really? Shut the fuck up. And it just...
Stop speaking English in the middle of the Kremlin. Right?
Well, not just that, but it's also... this is where it starts to strain just a little bit of credibility, because it's kind of like, this guy's been cleared for field duty, which means he's been cleared because he's professional and serious and takes it. Like, this isn't, hey, it's not...
He literally should have shown his, like, comic relief badge.
Don't get me wrong. I do find it kind of chuckle-inducing, and I get a grin out of it, but there's also, like, this isn't a heist movie. You know, a heist movie, you can understand why people are kind of joking around. They're all criminals. It's like, you know, whatever. But this is, like, they're trying to fucking save the world and, you know, prevent a nuclear disaster. It doesn't seem to be the time to be joking about how you're in the field in the Kremlin. And you're not just... breaking into, again, it's similar to the, you know, Mount Everest of hacks when they're trying to get into Langley in the first movie, is they're going to the Kremlin.
Yeah,
like,
that's a big deal.
Big deal. And he's just sitting there, like, spouting off these, like, funny lines. I'm like, it's a little, I kind of don't believe an agent cleared for field duty, even with a sense of humor, would be carrying on like that.
Yeah. Before I go about saying this, I realize this is incredibly apologetic. And, like, yes, obviously you're right. Like, no real spy would really be doing that. But I think what I'll give this movie credit for that it brought to it that I really liked and that is sort of lacking in the other movies is this idea of, yes, they're out saving the world and this is their job and they do this all the time. I think there's especially at the end where they're all sort of having a beer and laughing about how, like, San Francisco could have been a nuclear crater. It's like, yeah, it's like a really stressful, fucked up job where, like, if you mess up, like, billions of people die. And in my mind, it's like, how else do you deal with that but sort of start laughing about it? It's almost like a coroner, you know, who's, like, got this fucked up job and he's, like, starting to make jokes.
Yeah. And that's why it works in places. Like, for one of the places it works for me is when they figure out they have to get up to the server room in that building in Dubai.
Oh my god.
And you know, Simon Pegg's like, I got to be on the computer. I mean, it's just, I mean, those are funny, believable situations. And, you know, the look on Tom Cruise's face is like, really? I've got to climb this building with, like, these magic gloves that I hope.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. That's by the way, funny. We should cut right to it. That fucking Dubai thing, like, holy shit, that shit on the building, that shit's crazy.
Looks great. Yeah.
That's, in my opinion, that's kind of a slight callback to the open of Mission Impossible 2 with Tom Cruise on the rock.
Sure.
Yeah, being like, sure. Remember that, which had no point? We're going to do that again, but better, it's going to have a point, and you're going to really be invested in it instead of just impressed by, oh, wow, he's climbing a rock.
That's what he does for a hobby, but now he's doing it for the job.
And I feel like that's the thing that Brad Bird brings most to this movie. And, you know, you're pointing it out with some of the humor is there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek throughout, of, like, little hints and nods to things that have been done before without without the deliberateness of, say, a Scream movie, which is just, like, in-your-face referential.
Or Chainsaw,
like,
Bob little, walk by.
That type of stuff. This is much more like, if you're paying attention, they're pointing out little things that have been done in the previous movies. And, John, I think it was you afterwards that was pointing out, like, the whole movie is essentially them failing over and over and over again until they succeed at the very end.
Yeah. Because it's like I called it elaborate failure because it's so, like, elaborate, everything they go through going in the Kremlin and having that screen of that can just, you know, hide. That was actually really awesome.
Yeah, like, I love
this. I love that they actually, like, for your average Joe that would go see that movie and isn't incredibly tech savvy, they would just go like, okay, magic screen that shows the thing. But they literally go as far as to, like, show the camera that says eye tracking technology. Yeah. And, like, if you really want to be finite with it, and you could like kind of actually see it happening because it's tracking his perspective, it's doing the image based on where he's looking. That's like really awesome.
Yeah,
those are cool little touches that no one turns to the camera and says, "This is tracking the guy's eye move." Blah blah.
Yeah,
blah.
They just let it happen.
But they let that information on screen. But I don't. Yeah, but all that for nothing, for the Kremlin to just blow up and then like fuck up. And
yeah, and the whole elaborate. He crawls up to the server room to make sure that it's all like linked in so that they can control the elevators and the security cams. And then the guy still gets away with everything,
which are
real nuclear codes. Which they decide it. You know, they have to do it. Jeremy Renner's kind of not for it at first, but they have to let these nuclear codes, like real nuclear codes, go in order to actually get through this process with a guy, and he's kind of not on board with it, but then because he's like, this could go really bad for us, and like, this is our only shot. They do it, and the guy gets away with the nuclear codes.
They give him,
like,
and launches a nuke
that
almost works. Like,
yeah, it does. It's completely deployed. It just never explodes.
And we're forgetting, you know, And we're not forgetting this, but the whole thing is kicked off by this thing near the beginning of the movie where this whole thing goes wrong, and the secretary. Did we determine if he's the Secretary of Defense or state?
Got to be.
That's a good. This is Tom Wilkinson you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
He also has the Anthony Hopkins trailer role. Because he's in the trailer. Here's your mission.
It works so much better.
He's way better.
But then, then he gets killed.
Plus, in the plot, this horrible thing has happened, and Russia's about to go to nuclear war with the U.S. So he has this look on his face of just like, oh my fucking God, I've been like reamed out for 24 straight hours. He just looks pissed off.
But then again, the Secretary of Defense or State, whichever one he is, like, is killed. Killed while Tom Cruise is in the car. Yep. And it's just failure after failure after failure.
And he's not killed by the villain.
Yeah, no, he's
that's just a good point. Right. And that's actually a scene that got me, because that's such a cliche thing, like you're in a car and all of a sudden, boom, here they come. But it actually kind of surprised me. Like, they're like mid discussion. There's no soundtrack buildup, no nothing. It's literally out of fucking nowhere.
Yeah.
Boom, they get hit and he gets shot within a second. It's really good, because that's what it would be like if you're in the car. You'd be like, oh my God. Like, and there's also that, like you said, the movie's very tongue in cheek, because after that scene, they have the thing where he throws the flare they're in underwater and guys are shooting at him. And he throws a flare in a body. And moments later, Jeremy Renner, like, I guess, is playing the role of the questioning critic or somebody, like, someone who questions what's happening in the movie. He's like, why'd you think they would do that? That's so stupid. And then, Ethan Hunt's like, they're just trigger happy and they'll shoot at anything. It's cool. The movie's like almost justifying the stupidity of the logic of the movie. Like,
and I like when they get to when they're doing the preparation for that whole skyscraper sequence. They're making the masks.
Yeah,
and then
they
masks,
fuck up.
Like, get fucked up, and they don't get to use the masks.
Well, that was so clever to me, because you're like, oh, here come the masks. Here we go, and you're ready. And then they don't work. And I was literally like, oh, I guess we're not getting a mask. And then at the end of that whole sequence, the bad guy rips a mask off. And clearly for, I don't know, no reason at all, he's pretending to be the other guy. Like,
yeah, there was. I didn't understand why he needed to pretend to be someone else.
Who's working with him.
Yeah.
So it's not like there's not a misdirection or anything. It's just like, oh, you thought I was this bad guy? Nope. I'm the other one.
I mean, the most I could think is that, and this is the guy, I don't recall his name, but he's in the Swedish Girl with a Dragon
Michael
Tattoo.
Bloom, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'm assuming because of the popularity of that, he's now, made his way into this mainstream movie.
Yes.
But the only thing I can think to justify it is he's aware of the fact that the agents are after him and he's a known threat or something.
But so is
so
the
I
other
guess,
guy.
I here's what I'm thinking. He wants to do it himself, make sure it goes perfect, right? But he's their target. He's who they're going for. So if he walks in and it's him,
they'll just catch him.
The game over.
Yeah.
They'll stop.
But he's
somewhat aware that they're going to like let this guy get away with it. And he's thinking, hey, I get a shot at nuclear launch codes. So I need to go do this. If it's me, they'll come in and get me. So I'll just be this other guy. They'll let me go. And I'm so wily and smart that I'll get away. Although he barely almost doesn't.
Because why doesn't Simon Pegg just lock down the elevators?
But then what? Then they just attack him in the elevator.
Because the entire point is the entire point is that they want that guy to get away
so that they can
to
lead
go
him to the
back
next
to the bad guy.
Yeah.
But then they chase him anyway?
Well, no, no. What happens actually is Ethan Hunt is being very calm and cool, and he's kind of tailing him as he normally would. I imagine he wants to keep it low profile and just tail the guy. Right. But through happenstance, the Russian agent after him tries to stop him. And then what happens is a gunshot goes off as Ethan Hunt's trying to get away from those guys.
Yeah,
the guy turns around and is like, oh, shit, a gunshot.
Into a chase,
and that's when it becomes a chase because now he's on the run.
Yeah.
And Ethan Hunt wisely is like, well, okay, now he's got real nuclear launch codes.
Right.
I better not let this guy out of my fucking sight. And now he knows I'm onto him, so now it's a chase.
I thought that was all pretty well justified.
They make a point of showing that now the field agents are given these contact lenses with cameras in them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That they give Sawyer from Lost.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, I love Sawyer from Lost in this movie. I just want to point that out.
And Josh Holloway's theatrical debut is photographed through IMAX cameras.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. That was his first theatrical release.
But we were fortunate enough to see this movie in a real IMAX in LA. Yeah.
For my money, I don't get the whole 3D craze. It really doesn't work for me. I've actually stopped seeing movies in 3D because I'm just tired of it.
I was incredibly glad that Mission Impossible 4 was not 3D. Like, that they just didn't go there.
Yeah.
Because I'll take IMAX over 3D every time.
Because
the IMAX sequences, I mean, much like The Dark Knight in Mission Impossible 4, are awesome.
Yes. Yeah. And Christopher Nolan is, you know, a big proponent of that. I mean, that's why he's pushing Dark Knight Rises as an IMAX movie, is because he thinks that the future of movie going is IMAX, not 3D. Because 3D, at the end of the day, really tends to be a gimmick. Like, it can be, you can shoot a movie from scratch in 3D and get like a greater depth of field and feel like you're more a part of the movie. I mean, as much as I have issues with this movie a lot, Avatar does do that to an extent. When you watch that movie in 3D, it does really bring an environment to life.
And also for the record, I'll point out, I saw like Hugo the other day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, I don't know if you've seen that. Yeah, that also has actually very well done in good 3D worth paying to see.
Yeah, I mean,
that's all I'll say.
You put a good director behind it and they can use 3D well. Still, at the end of the day, it's only adding a certain element to it. You know, it's just a little bit of depth and maybe a little bit of in your face that can be more tastefully handled than the joke 3D that we're usually used to. But IMAX to me is so much more immersive. I remember doing the whole skyscraper sequence. I mean, just the first reveal. I mean, you're in IMAX, and I just, you know, I'm not really afraid of heights. But wow, there was a moment I was like, whoa, okay, we're really high here. And you feel like you're with him. And
that is an incredibly impressive sequence.
Yeah.
I don't know how they fucking got that on film. I can't believe no one died. Like, it looks so fucking terrifying. Like, and it's clearly like really Tom Cruise out there.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's not just some guy that they put his face on. Like, it's fucking Tom Cruise on the side of a fucking the world's tallest building.
Yeah. No, he's known crazy. For that in general to do. He's done all his stunts throughout all four of these movies. I mean, the bigger deal, I know, just to throw back to it real fast, and we referenced the rock climbing in two. But he did that in two without a safety net, and that whole like thing where he kind of like made a jump or a swing or something like that.
Yeah,
he like tore his shoulder doing that. And the studio, I guess, was terrified that he was going to die because he refused to do it with a stunt double or a safety net.
He
has harnesses and all that like a normal like rock climber would have. But he's notorious for saying that, nope, I'm just going to do this. Same thing with the first movie, the whole sequence with the aquarium and all that. They were worried he was gonna drown with all that water, and he was like, no, I'm doing it.
That's awesome. That's good for him. I guess when you're level 28 clear with no thetons or whatever, you can do crazy shit.
The man clears, like, because he gets profit participation in these movies, like the man clears like 70 plus million for all of these movies, each one.
You know, normally I'd say that it's outrageous, but that building was pretty fucking high. Give that man the millions, because I couldn't do it from like the third floor. I'd like shit my pants.
Yeah.
I can't believe he did that. I wouldn't know where Brad Bird was while they were directing that. Like, I would hope he's like Lars von Trier in some basement, like miles away from being that high up. Because I couldn't direct that scene. I'd like shit my pants.
I don't know how he did it. Like a really high crane. Yeah. He's like right next to him.
Or the helicopter.
He's like that. I bet you he's on the ground or
he's got to have monitors or something.
Oh yeah, monitors. And I mean, I would also assume that he's probably in the like in the building itself, maybe.
Yeah.
Like high up, like near him. But
they got a fucking cameraman out there, I guess, right? Or is it a rig? Like
it's probably a rig. I don't know for sure. I mean, it's IMAX.
Somebody was ballsy.
That's the other thing with IMAX cameras. Their IMAX cameras are really, really loud,
and they're big.
Which is that's why they're loud. Is they're huge.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's one of the big tricks to filming in IMAX is that you have to worry about sound a lot. You can't film an intimate scene in IMAX because if you do, all you're going to hear is the camera going.
Well, that's why they're reserved for these sort of like action set piece scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you can tell that that's when they turn it on and, you know. And it's actually cool because you actually get like an aspect ratio shift because the movie is your standard, like, what is it? 1.85 or whatever. And then, or maybe 2.35.
Yeah. I don't know. I have to check to see if it's widescreen.
Like really widescreen. And then it kind of becomes like jumbo full frame because literally it's almost like it breaks the black frames and just fills up everything in sight. And it's always really fun.
And extra clarity helps too. So the field day agents now have lenses that are cameras, and we see when they're in that building in Dubai that the camera is attached to a printer inside of a briefcase, and their plan is to duplicate the launch codes.
Oh yeah, that was wild. With like, he's taking printer. Photos with it.
Exactly. What threw me off, and I still haven't been able to figure it out myself now. Brandt has one of the lenses in, and he's the one who's standing in for the man who's verifying the launch codes, so that he'll get the launch codes that were stolen from the assassin. Those are the real ones, the original ones. He's supposed to look at them, and they're supposed to print out on the other side in the other room.
Yeah,
yeah.
They made a point of showing us in the scene, but before when they're explaining what's going to happen, Paula Patton's character says that for whatever reason the way the camera captures it, they're rearranged on the other side.
No,
right?
No. I think what
do they correct that?
I mean, yeah, go right ahead.
Well, the reason they wanted the numbers scrambled and not the words was so that they wouldn't have the real launch codes.
Right.
But then they had to change it at the last second. Because,
so they did.
So yeah. So he asked Simon Pegg, "How long will it take you to reprogram the case?"
Right.
Yeah.
And so now it's printing exact copies.
And then he does.
That's part of the we're just adding more shit as the clock takes down. Right. Like, you got to do this now. Oh my God, there's no time. Like, it's that. Yeah.
Okay.
That also leads to an incredibly funny moment where, cause Simon Pegg's running around like while Tom Cruise is on the fucking side of the building, that they're like changing room numbers hallway
on the door. That's
and then
it.
He's left to do it solo. And right after Tom Cruise finally gets back, he runs in and he's like, "Woo! Oh man, that was real hard." he was doing this like menial, stupid task, and he's literally like, "Oh, woo!" like wiping his head.
But he had to do it on two
funny.
Different floors.
Yeah, I know. Oh, it was undeniably tough, but it's just hilarious when Tom Cruise almost falls to his death like so many times.
My favorite line of that movie is still when he's running down the side of the building with the cord, and it doesn't reach, and Jeremy Renner's all, "Your line's not long enough." No shit. It was just so gentle, like the look on Tom Cruise's face and the way he said it was just so perfect.
And the way he runs down that line, because it's really cool. The whole sequence is so slow and methodical, and he's sort of going and almost falling every now and then. And then right when he's like, "Well, I gotta go down, and I got like 1 minute," he just fucking jumps out and runs vertical with this like thing. And the music, that Michael Giacchino music's like really swelling up and. It's really good. So also, speaking of Michael Giacchino, I really loved his score for all the Kremlin stuff. This like old Russian Cold War like
march song.
Yeah, it sounded like
flag waving,
like Russian national anthem or something. I thought that was really awesome.
Yeah, it's great.
Did a good job of that.
One more thing I want to say about the sequence in Dubai. I really really loved seeing this very small IMF team. Is reduced to just plain bluffing without wearing any makeup or with a minimum amount of tools and special weapons and things. That's the most exciting thing for me. That they don't know if the assassin knows what the other two people are really supposed to look like, even if they've met. So
because there's that moment in where they're just like, well. What if they have met?
Right. What if they have? Opens, and they don't know.
And again, it plays off of the kind of tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
We've gone through so many movies where people always have masks.
Right.
They're always ready and prepared. Their mask fails.
Yes.
They're literally reduced to, well, let's hope this works.
Yeah.
And
just bluffing.
And again, and the whole thing is set up too, that the whole setup to this movie is once the secretary has killed Tom Wilkinson earlier in the movie, that they're reduced to, it's the four of them. The whole ghost protocol is essentially they will be disavowed.
Yeah.
Nothing that they do is going to be backed or approved by the government.
Yeah. He has that awesome line. He's like, us and this like train car. Yeah. That's it.
It's all that we have. The four of them versus the world to try and stop this nuclear attack on the West Coast. And so, you know, that's what I think I really loved about it is so many spy movies and thrillers like this. Sure, some stuff can be tense and kind of go wrong, but it always seems to work out. And they seem to have just like everything works at their disposal. And they're perfect agents. And that's your point really resonated with me, John. Like, this is a movie of failure from start to finish.
Right. Yeah.
Things not working, things going wrong. These four people up against the most impossible odds, and they continue to screw up and not get it quite right. And they have to figure out how to get it quite right.
Yeah.
And it happens at the end, because that's what happens in a movie like this. They're going to succeed. But
I mean, to me, it reminds me of there's that really tense scene where the guy's getting ready to launch the nukes. And they're in – this is when they're in India, and they've got that super awesome car that shows you, like – it's like eat your heart out Google Maps. It's like the best way to travel.
The Minority Report mobile.
Yeah, and you're sitting there like, I'm literally watching like, yeah, okay, they're going to make it. They're going to stop the guy into the movie, and the fucking dude launches the nukes, and there's this just moment. You see it in the air, and they're like, shit. And then you literally – it's like – I'm like, how on God's green earth are they possibly going to stop this now? And then he's just like – fuck it, we got it. And then they're just like, yeah, like improv-ing it all. Like, I don't even think Ethan Hunt even knows how he's going to stop Nuke. He's just like, I got to get to that guy. I'll figure it out.
He says there has to be a way.
Yeah. Which, of course, leads us to the big when he finally gets the suitcase and he yells, mission accomplished, and like hits the button after getting it from the bad guy.
Again, like that's one of the moments that's a little too far for me.
Dude,
like,
amazing. I loved it so much because it's so stupid.
I know, it's right up your alley.
I really did not enjoy the whole Indian scene where they're trying to seduce
the guy from Slumdog Billionaire.
For some kind of access code, and then Jeremy Renner has to jump down this enormous shaft to some server room, which this guy has built, I guess, beneath his house.
Yeah.
Which was odd as well.
You know,
I liked it.
Yeah, I'll confess there was I thought the Jeremy Renner stuff was great, like the magnet thing.
Yeah.
But I'll admit the whole I forgot the woman's name, but
Paula Patton.
Paula Patton, thank you.
But
like
Carter,
her whole mission, there was like an odd. Like, I love the stuff with her and the assassin, and, like, she's got vengeance for her, like, ex-boyfriend or the guy that died.
Yeah.
But, like, I agree. Like, there was something off about her trying to seduce that guy. They seem to me make this whole plot of, like, she just didn't have it in her to do it, and she was really, but I kept just sitting there being like, you know, don't wait or anything, but the whole fucking world's about to, like, blow up in nuclear Armageddon. You think you could, like, get it up to, like, put your tits in this guy's face and get this fucking coat? Like, I just didn't care that she was, like, really sad and, like, didn't want to seduce him. It's like, get your shit together, lady. Like, come on.
Well, and just the fact, I mean, like, I guess, like, they needed the access code to get access to the server, to get access to the satellite.
Right.
I don't know. Does Bill Gates know all the access codes to his satellites?
That's a good question.
I mean, it just seems like that's not information that he would have. He doesn't care about
that. Oh, right,
because
he has it, like, memorized.
Right.
She's like, give me the fucking code. And he's like, 2H75.
Yeah, it's like
especially when he's thinking with his penis.
Yeah.
He won't be able to concentrate on it.
He's just like a playboy millionaire. He's got all these phones. He's texting. It's like he acts like a total idiot.
And I have to confess just slightly that the stuff with the 17 cell phones and him being like, come find me. Like, it kind of got a laugh out of me.
Yeah,
a little
it's
bit.
Funny.
Like,
it's one of the problems I had with the movie. But
yeah, I'll agree that's kind of one of the weaker.
Yeah.
At that point, it's almost like you've had so many bang up amazing scenes. It's like, I guess they can't all win.
Well, because even the car park scene is amazing.
Yeah, like that whole set piece at the end is great.
But just the fact, like, you know, Tom Cruise he's not a young man, but this guy, like, is clearly, like, in his 60s.
He's talking about the villain.
The villain.
He's not in his 60s.
Well, he's an older.
No, I'd say, like, 50s.
No.
Well, he's
in the 50s.
40s.
He was a leader, like, in the Russian during the Cold War.
Yeah, he's a holdover from the Cold War.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, he's got to be.
I mean, despite the age of the actor, I don't know how old that guy is, but yeah, I could see him as like an older guy.
But just like the, he has so much trouble fighting him.
Okay, yeah.
I just didn't get why like this guy was like a strategist, how he had so much fighting.
Oh, I see. You're saying Tom Cruise should have just wiped the floor.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
But this guy's like just totally destroying
I think
Tom
it
Cruise.
Helps that because it's not – the fight seems less about trying to best the other guy and more about who can get to the briefcase first.
But we know
– So I feel like he's – that's like more their focus and they're sort of just fighting as they're trying to get to the briefcase.
Yeah, we just know so little about the villain. He's really –
He's insane.
He's some crazy guy.
Yeah.
We know kind of why he's doing it, but we don't know why the people are supporting him. Like, he's got people working for him.
Yeah,
and they must
that's
be.
True.
Yeah, well, it's really cool. All we see is – I mean, because you can assume the assassin's hired. So really you have him and then the other guy. Yeah. And I guess you could assume the other guy's, like, indoctrinated with him or something. But I found it really – as a plot-wise, it's pretty cool to have this villain that, like, his goal isn't – to nuke the world because he hates everybody. He's literally like lost his fucking mind and is like, no, it'll be a peaceful post-apocalypse.
To cleanse us. Like, I kind of like that.
Yeah, he's sort of that. Cartoonish, yeah, but he's that villain that like thinks what he's doing is good. Like, he's not doing it because he's evil. He's doing it because like he thinks it's the thing to do.
It's the solution.
But so much so that with that briefcase, he like literally jumps to his death, like basically death.
That's how crazy he is. Yeah. He figures, I'm going to defend it by destroying myself.
That was fast.
Just letting it happen.
Just so you know, like the guy who, and I know we're arguing a little bit about the character's age versus the actress's, but the actor is just barely 50.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You're 50. That's the official thing.
No, but just barely. That's what I mean. Is
so.
I
so I was just barely right.
That's fine. You were saying like 60s. I'm like, he's not that old. Like, not even close.
That's true.
Like, he's just barely. Yeah. 50, and to be fair, I mean, let me look up Tom Cruise real fast, but I believe Tom Cruise, like, he looks good for his age.
So he was 20 years old plotting stuff for the Russian government.
I wouldn't put it past him. And if the guy was smart enough,
yeah,
I'm
I would
sure
just like
Soviets
to point out
that
Tom Cruise is 2 years younger than the actor he was playing.
Wow.
Tom Cruise, that actor was born in 1960. Tom Cruise was born in 1962.
That's incredible.
I'm just saying, like, I didn't get the age problem that you were getting in that scene.
But I see what Richard's saying is, if you take the plot for what it is, that he's a Russian general that was in charge of nuclear war for
him in
the Soviet Union.
Then, but, you know, Tom
Cruise
is in his 40s.
Because, when was the fall of the Soviet Union? Like, 91? Is that right? Like, when the wall went down?
Yeah, it's. I guess that's my question to you, is when do you think that this guy was, like, because, if you think this guy was in the 50s and the 60s.
No,
I mean,
no.
So
I would say 80s. But even then, that's 30
puts him
years.
At 20. That's put him to 20. So he's, you know, that would. If
but
he's
yeah,
in the 80s,
to 20. But you're, he's right. For that caliber of a role, I feel like you'd be in your 30s. In that time, like you wouldn't be a 20-year-old in charge of like all nuclear war.
He's supposed to be a genius.
I think
that's true.
Yeah. But I think that this goes in with my problem is we don't know anything about this man.
That's true too.
We don't know enough about him.
That's fine.
And that's what makes him a weak villain to me. He does some cool, you know, he's got some moments, but there's no interaction really with him and Ethan until the end.
Well, he's no Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I think we were talking about this earlier. Like, this is the thing about this movie, to speak to your point, Richard, is that what you've got in the first three movies is Ethan Hunt versus a villain with a supporting cast around him that helps him achieve his goals against said villain. This movie transfers to become a team led by Tom Cruise, but a team.
Yep.
All those other guys get, you know, Renner, Paula Patton, Simon Pegg get a good screen time, and their characters and their motivations and their backstories are much more established than the villain. And I think that that's a conscious choice. That is a meant to say, like, one, I don't know that we want Tom Cruise being the lone guy carrying this series anymore, but two, we want to put more focus on those people than the villain. And that's a choice. And I agree.
And there's only so much time in the movie.
Exactly. Right? I sense and I can see why you have an issue with that. But at the end of the day, there's also, you can make the argument of the MacGuffin. Like, it's a villain. He's trying to do X. That's all that ultimately matters. And what we care about is the rest of what's going on around it. And it's all really well handled and really well done with the other characters. Yeah. I don't think we really have too much of an issue with any of the characters. I know you pointed out the Paula Patton thing about, oh my God, just get the codes. The world's going to end.
That's such a minor complaint.
That's what I mean. Yeah, it's like you care about the other four people and you're interested in seeing the way they're they're doing it, it seems to be much more about their process and their problems versus what the villain is trying to achieve.
But you know, Richard, I will completely grant you of, I mean, save maybe the Sega movie, which is obviously the worst. I'd say he's like runner up. Like he's like, I'd put one in three's villains over him. Absolutely.
Oh yeah.
And he's definitely not as well rounded.
I would totally give you that. Yeah. Absolutely. I would just say that that is deliberate. That's not we forgot to do this or this is a weakness in the script. This is it's okay. We're just not going to focus on the villain as much in this movie.
And I agree that about that. I agree that there's a choice. I just didn't like the choice.
That's fair.
That's fair.
And Stu, to what you're talking about the team, I'll go on record as like, I really like that turn in the plot have. Like, I never thought Jeremy Renner would like have this plot about he feels guilty about the wife's death. They really added depth to him that I was not expecting.
Yeah.
Simon Pegg is incredibly funny and obviously just comic relief, but he has some good moments. And then the woman's story with Josh Sawyer Holloway. And stuff. Yeah. I felt really bad for her.
That's just Sawyer to you.
Oh, no. Yeah, he is just Sawyer.
He cut his hair.
He's
not James Ford anymore. Secret Agent Sawyer.
He has a name. Josh Holloway.
No.
He cut his hair. He's not James Ford anymore.
I have to say that you were mentioning that there was another Mission Impossible movie that they're going to go forward with, or hopefully.
They're looking at the like ridiculous box office return.
Yeah.
This movie has made almost $200 million domestically, and I think it's already made like $200 to $400 million worldwide. So that's like $600 million, and this was made for the same budget that the third one was made for, which is like $150 million, I think. So they're gonna turn a hefty profit on
this.
But
in my mind, a sequel to this movie will be the first time in any of these movies where I will be severely disappointed if not most of those people don't return for the next movie.
Yeah.
Like any of the other crews, like, hey, whatever, they were fun, but I understand why they're not in the next one. If it's not Simon Pegg and the gang in the next movie, I'm gonna be really sad.
What about Luther?
Which one's Luther?
Luther Stickles.
Oh, yes. No, that's because I was actually about to say, I was like,
there more than
I was
time,
like,
right?
if they took the crew from Ghost Protocol and then inserted Ving Rhames into a significant I'm with you guys role, I will shit myself.
That should be good.
Can't wait.
And again, this is all just rumor. There's no like attached to anything, but apparently Brad Bird is in discussions also to return, which would be the first time a director returns to the series. And I mean, I think that's the thing about Brad Bird. I think that would be good for him as long as they give him the same type of, creative leeway that they did with this movie, which I would assume that, it seemed to be beneficial to everyone, creatively and financially.
And the movie was a really good fit for him in terms
of
transitioning into like live action movies.
Like J.J. Abrams transitioning from television, this is Brad Bird's first feature film live action, because he's known obviously for The Incredibles and The Iron Giant and a lot of work on The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. So he's always worked in animation before this.
Yeah.
And so this is his first, and I was really curious to see how he handled it. And I'll admit, like, the trailer, while it looked cool, worried me a little, because I worried that he just got slotted into BS action movie.
Yeah. I confess, I saw the trailer and I was like, I guess this will be good. It was like the biggest surprise to me how great the movie was.
Yeah, and you can sense, like, I can sense Brad Bird's personality behind the camera in the movie. And again, like, I know I mentioned it briefly when we were comparing him and J.J. Abrams, but the way he shot this movie, like, the only complaints that I really had visually was there are a couple of iffy CG moments. When the Kremlin explodes is kind of crappy.
And the, like, sandstorm.
The sandstorm, the sequence is well handled when they're chasing. It's the coming of the sandstorm.
Yeah,
when,
once it's finally in. And
it's fine. Yeah, when Tom Cruise is like, even the wide shots when they see it on the horizon, I'm okay with that. But when he's like running from the skyscraper and the sandstorm is coming in, I'm like, ooh, that
they're actually like virtually the same shot. It's like Tom Cruise running while something comes behind him, this big smoky cloud.
And I'm kind of like, it looks like that was rendered 5 hours ago.
Yeah.
Hey,
man, smoke's hard to do.
It is. But, luckily,
the mummy head. It turns into the mummy head as it comes.
Luckily, that stuff was kept at a minimum.
And it's there and gone like real fast. So you can just kind of get over it.
I would love to see if, they gave Brad Bird another one and he did another good one and then use that to branch out to do some other live action stuff. Although, I mean, I'll be honest, I want a sequel to The Incredibles.
Right. Oh, man, that'd be good. And that to me was the biggest Brad Bird connection that I could see. Like, all the sort of high-tech yet retro-tech kind of feel to it. It felt very Incredibles. Like, when Ethan
Hunt...
The
Dean Martin music, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that whole opening prison sequence is awesome. But, like, him going to the phone and getting scanned in, and it's like, hello, Ethan Hunt. This is your like, that's... Yeah. That to me, and it felt a lot like the old show in a way that these other movies really don't. Mm-hmm. Of like, sort of, here's your mission, get into the Kremlin. Thanks, have a good time. And he's like, oh my god,
that phone is hilarious. By the way, not just the old retro, you know, feel of it, but the fact that it's like this message will self destruct, and he walks away, and it doesn't explode, and then he goes back and he taps it, and then it explodes.
It's like the IMF hasn't changed out their equipment in like 40 years or something.
Oh, and when it like says like you know that this leaves you 4 hours to complete the mission.
Do you know what it reminded me a little bit of? It reminded me of that sequence in Die Hard when Samuel L. Jackson and Bruce Willis are just like, we can't just leave. Is there some kid? And finally, it reminded me of that. Of like, Tom Cruise, like, I can't just leave that here. Someone's going to walk up and it's going to explode. I have to go do it.
It reminded me of Get Smart, actually.
Totally. Well, I think Get Smart's even, it's clearly lifting sort of a page from that mission. And especially like Inspector Gadget as well, like the self-destructing.
Well, Inspector Gadget was Mission Possible.
Yeah, exactly. But I think because they're both Don Adams or whatever, I just sort of thought.
I'll also to talk about that phone not exploding and IMF seemingly having faulty or old equipment. By the end of the movie, they've made a complete turnaround where we can assume that IMF is back or is at least cemented again with the government because of the vindication with the Russian police. By the end of it all, now these IMF members are receiving their instructions from iPhones.
Yeah, that's another there's a lot no more of iPhones now. And iPads from my memory in the movie. I think the Kremlin thing was like an iPad.
Yeah, his
thing.
Control unit for the for the camera.
Yeah, and they put in the little like Mac like earbuds and get their mission and stuff. I mean, it's at least it's a subtle product placement, but it definitely kind of stuck out a little bit.
That's actually one of the things that for me really works about the placement of like Apple products is that they're subtle. The way that Steve Jobs and Apple designed those were to be just sleek and modern, and you know that they're Apple products, but it doesn't. It's not like Mountain Dew, Xbox, like it's Michael Bay stuff.
He's like, here's your mission, guys, and he puts out a bunch of Pepsi Max like around the table. Yeah,
it's just like it's not
under the cap.
but there's something what's so nice about those designs is they're iconic and you can recognize them, but they're not like Apple.
Right.
Like,
it's not super intrusive.
Dale.
Yeah. And and it's believable too. That's the other thing is I believe that, you know, high tech people may turn to Apple products to help them save the world because they're really like,
oh man, I want my IMF Apple iPhone with my secret missions.
Yeah,
but
they track your location and
it's true.
And they self-destruct. You get a new
one
every
day. They track your location all night, Richard.
So when you jailbreak your phone, are you disavowed? Is that, that how it works?
I think so.
I wanted to go back a little bit because, again, I have issues with some of the plot points of the movie, and I want to make it seem like I don't like this movie, Ghost Protocol, because I really did enjoy it.
No,
I had
a lot
of fun.
We should make a segment called Richard's Quibbles, because this comes up a lot, but I kind of love it. I like this sort of minute attention.
I really, really got upset at the laughing off of Jeremy Renner's pain and guilt and anguish about the wife.
Right.
So, you know, she's still alive. He's all, she's still alive. Oh, haha. I mean, like, what?
Right, because he left, like, his agency, basically.
He couldn't handle his job anymore. He had to take a new position. He's probably drinking himself and cutting on his arms at night,
playing
sobbing.
Russian roulette, like, in a hotel room.
Look at Mel Gibson in, like, Lethal Weapon. Like, he's so, like, that's how I pictured him, so distraught. And then in the end, it's like, oh, well, we couldn't tell anybody. It's like, yeah, I guess, but... I just felt so bad.
Thanks
for
ruining him. Right, his life is unruined pretty much immediately. Like,
yeah.
Well, like, oh, yeah. Thanks. I just to slightly respond to that. I totally see that quibble. The one thing that kind of makes it fly for me a little bit, maybe not the kind of quick recovery from it, but the decision to do that is that, I mean, government and especially intelligence is so cold and bureaucratic. Like, I can totally see them not giving two shits about this guy, like not telling him that this was, you know, an operation that was fake and all that, and letting him believe that because they don't care. You know, their only goal is what's best for the intelligence agency community, all of that. And so therefore, and Ethan Hunt is obviously going to be a higher ranking agent with a track record of success than yes. Jeremy Renner's character. So it's like, if his career is collateral damage to save Ethan Hunt's, they're going to do it. And so I buy the decision to treat it that way. I will agree with you that the way it just kind of recovers is, yeah. is a little too flippant yeah. and easy, but the decision to do it, I believe could happen. I believe probably does happen.
I walked out of the theater thinking, well, that's the setup for a supervillain. Like that's the kind of something oh, that would wow. turn Man. Someone evil.
Dude, next movie, Jeremy Renner, the bad guy.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you know what this did to me? I'm gonna kill your wife to justify the anguish I
got. We get like the repeat of like Mission Impossible 3, right. and Tom Cruise is like, come on, dude, I've already done this.
By the way, I think it's interesting that we think his wife's dead and then she's alive at the end, but I'm putting him on watch. It's two movies in a row where you think the wife's dead and then she's not. So right. next movie, we better not have another like she's dead.
She probably won't
not.
Be there at all by next movie.
Nah,
that's yeah. what I'm hoping. Living apart. Well, I like the way they handled that because I'll admit that in the beginning and in the middle of the movie, I was a little angry with it because I hate when movie series do that, which
right.
is
sort of
they use a plot device in a certain, like in the third one, to connect him, ground him with a wife and a life outside of the agency. And they use that emotionally to make the plot for the third one. And then it just gets wiped away in the next movie and becomes irrelevant.
She left him.
Oh, they're not together
like,
anymore.
Oh, right? She left him. They're not together. She died. Like, just like so easy. And I hate that. I really, really hate that. And I love that they play off of your expectations yeah. with that you think that they're going to do the same thing that every freaking movie series does. And then you realize that, no, we're going to treat it with a little bit of respect. We're going to subvert your expectations and show you that we did think about this. We're going to put a little clever twist on it. And I agree. I think that in another one, she's not going to be there. This is their way of handling that exactly. in a mature way, getting rid of it and not bringing it back. Because, I mean, honestly, if they wanted Michelle Monaghan back, they could just bring her back.
Like, yeah,
she would have been in this movie in some capacity. They decided they didn't want to do that. So I think this is their way of maturely moving away from that storyline, which I liked. I thought it was a clever way to handle it.
You guys have anything else for Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol?
One last thing.
Yeah, what you got?
The return of Luther for the last scene mm-hmm. where he gets to make a joke about Ethan having just foiled the bad guy's plot, and he even calls Ethan cheesy. About his mission accomplished.
He says, yeah, that's another. Always. It's like a self-analyzing moment. Again.
Yeah, and it's fun to see it come from him. It's too bad that he couldn't have been in the movie, or I suppose it was that Ving Rhames just wanted too much money and they didn't give it to him. But then they finally wrote him a part later.
I just saw it as like fan service.
Yeah.
I saw it as like, hey, this guy's been out a lot. He's getting kind of old. We don't necessarily need him for this movie.
He's not putting every mission.
I like the team being a fresh new team. Okay. But it's a cool nod for him to just be like, so, it's me.
Yeah.
I'm still here.
I'm still here. I'm still at work. Yeah.
And plus, he's funny. He's like, I've been in the bay, like, getting rid of nuclear weapons, right. you fucking asshole. Like, yeah. And there's a cool moment where he's like, beer's on me. And he's like, yeah, you know it.
Yeah, yeah.
He flips him off.
Yeah, flips him a bird. Their sort of rapport of like, yeah.
I like just seeing that.
Frat boys together. Exactly. That's fun. Guys, anything else? Mission Impossible? We cover it all?
That's good.
Yeah, overall, it's just a really solid series. Like, it's very rare that so many are that good. I mean, it's almost like the second one, like, took all this shit upon itself.
Yeah.
And it balances the scales because that one's terrible. Yeah, but
it saved us 10 years of bad movies. We just got it all off the table at one time, and now we can enjoy it.
Exactly.
Movies.
It's nice.
And it's pleasant in a marathon not pleasant to watch a bad movie, but I like it when we get the bad one out of the way early on. Because I feel like, especially the ones where they just, here comes the ship patrol, and it just is like movie after movie. I love ending these marathons on like good movies. That's always fun.
It cleanses the palate.
Yeah. So overall, it's a highly recommended marathon. Very easy to watch.
And the theater thing is a real nice touch, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've done that twice now. And it's a nice way to cap the marathon to see something brand new in a theatrical environment. It's, I don't know.
Yeah.
It brings...
I mean, I ideally, because we love movies so much, I wish we could watch them all in a theater. But obviously that's, you know, pretty impossible. I think the only time we even did it was Jurassic Park. We were fortunate enough to see them all in the theater.
I knew it wouldn't happen, which is why I didn't bring it up. So I apologize for kind of teasing this. But down at the Egyptian where you guys did Jurassic Park on January 1st, they did Back to the Future. The trilogy.
Man.
And I was kind of like, but I knew like so many people were out of town. Yeah. And I was kind of like, because I almost thought, I'm like, I know we had talked about Mission Impossible, but it's like, it's Back to the Future in the theater, all definitely. Three of them back that's to back. Nice. It would probably. And they were all like restored prints, I believe. Yeah. I don't think that it was like them screening the Blu-rays or anything. So,
well, I haven't seen all three, but I was really fortunate on the anniversary. I think it was like, was it the 30th?
Oh, you went and saw the original in the theater.
I was lucky enough to see Back to the Future in the theater. Hmm. And that was great. Like, what a great theater movie. Yeah. Totally worth seeing.
I have here, I guess we should start a new segment for Cine Marathon. I guess I'll call it like Cine Mailbag or something like that.
You should come up with something better.
Yeah, please come up with
Cine Mailbag. It's what I'm going to make a jingle. Here comes the Cine Mailbag. Or just mail call. So a new segment, mail call, because we got an email from a listener from Chris. Who had a suggestion, and he writes to us, he says, "Hey guys, how about doing a Rocky marathon, or now that we have the newest Planet of the Apes, do a Planet of the Apes marathon?" And he says, "Keep up the good work, hope to hear from you guys soon."
Okay.
So thank you, Chris, for your email. Much appreciated. I think those are really good suggestions. And of the two, I think that I like Planet of the Apes. I think that's a good one to do.
My vote would very much be in favor of Planet of the Apes.
Absolutely.
There's more movies there.
Because we have a recent movie that just came out last year, and obviously many more before that.
Yeah. There's
a nice Tim Burton stinker in there, you know, just really, oh man, I hate that one. But yeah, no, I love Planet of the Apes, so I think that's the next marathon.
Cool.
Now, I'll have to let the listeners know, unfortunately, in the month of February, I'm actually...
Unfortunately, John?
Well, yeah. Well, unfortunately for you, dear listener, but fortunate enough for me, I'm actually getting married in February. I've actually gotten a couple of people have reviewed us and said that they love the podcast, but they wish we could do more of them. And honestly, listeners, like, I wish we could do two. If I had my way, we'd put out one a week. It'd be amazing. I'm sorry there's so little, but it's... Honestly, we all have, you know, lives outside of this podcast.
And John puts a lot of work into these episodes.
Absolutely.
He does, yeah.
There's jobs to work and things to do. And just the nature of the podcast is it takes so much time to watch all these movies.
It's at least a 3-step process.
Yeah.
And they can't all happen in one day.
Exactly.
In a short one like this, sometimes, you know, you can do the podcast in the same day. But, I mean, the zombie podcast, I mean, I don't even want to know what that podcast would sound like if we had done that right after we'd watched all those movies.
It would sound like zombies.
But long story short, for the month of February, since I'm getting married, my month has filled up incredibly fast. So I apologize, but I think we're going to have to take February off. But stay tuned, because in March, we will watch the Planet of the Apes movies, and we will have our next podcast then. And we have plenty of old episodes to listen to if you just can't wait for Cine Marathon. Go back, you know, listen to an old one.
Yeah.
It'll be good.
Peruse the James Bond catalog.
Absolutely. But we're always looking for suggestions and marathons or any questions or comments. So feel free to email us at cinemarathon@gmail.com. We also have a Twitter account that we live tweet every time we do a marathon. And we actually did it for Mission Impossible as well. So if you missed that, follow us at cinemarathonpod on Twitter. And also we have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/cinemarathon. And essentially the Twitter and Facebook page are kind of the same thing. So take your preference. We'll be posting on both. And you can also follow us there to see, you know, what we'll announce when our next marathons are. Well, I'll sort of just update people. So feel free to check those out. And all of this information can be found on our website, which is cinemarathonpodcast.com.
Yes.
So, gentlemen, thank you for joining me this month.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, I'm glad you accepted the mission. It's much appreciated.
This podcast will self-destruct.
Yes, throw your Mission Impossible branded iPhones to the wind as they explode. And we will see you guys in March. Have a good one.